First question, how can one enjoy meditation when one's knees are on fire? Well, it's what I'm experiencing. There's a whole variety of things. Is changing posture in the sense of doing sitting in a chair, using a bench, using more cushions sort of raise the height of how you're sitting, doing walking meditation, doing standing meditation. Just working with the different postures. In meditation, there isn't the kind of ethos of no pain, no gain. Pain is something that it distracts the mind. That being said, I don't know anybody's body who doesn't have any pain at all. So it's the nature of having a body is that they're kind of painful. To a certain degree, when one's experiencing pain or discomfort, learning how to direct attention to the feeling of pain, learning how to relax around it, breathing into it. This is where the breath meditation is, it's not just trying to get an efficient bellow system going in and out. It's like using the breath as a vehicle for exploring the body, exploring feeling, exploring the mind, exploring the Dhamma. So that by taking a painful sensation and then learning how to, that like the knees are on fire, just literally breathing cool, soothing energy into the knees and breathing in, breathing out, through that sensation, and relaxing and expanding, bringing light in, because sometimes actually we were just talking at tea time, and Debbie's been experimenting just using green light, and using a green light with the breath. And going into the pain, so that with the rhythm of the breath, visualization of green light, and then bathing the sensation of something that's painful with that green light. It makes it interesting, and it tends to open it up and feel, well, at least bearable anyway. And one of the things is when the meditation becomes interesting, you find the body really relaxes and settles. And oftentimes pain just really dissipates when the body becomes really relaxed. Now that being said, then you still need to pay attention to, because sometimes pain is actually telling you something, like get up, do something else. And you have to be able to use discernment to sort of say, okay, well, it's time to go and especially with the knees, just being able to have a bit of a break from sitting on the floor. I mean, there's chairs, there's the whole sort of bank of these benches at the back from the chapel. I imagine the nuns used to do their chanting and prayers there. I was just last week I was in England and I was at a cathedral, Winchester Cathedral, and the majority of it was built shortly after William the Conqueror, 1066, and so it's an ancient cathedral. There's this old section of the altar space up in the front with places for the monks. This is pre-Henry VIII, when the monastery still belonged to the cathedrals still belong to the monasteries and the Catholics. And there's the kind of seats like that, but then there's the seat goes up, so you can do a lot of standing and chanting. But then there's this sneaky little seat that's a part when you tilt it up. There's this little sort of seat about this wide, about maybe 6 inches wide, so you can kind of cheat and lean back, like get your butt on that, and just take the weight off your legs. So I mean, monks and meditators have been finding ways to deal with the body for a long time. So you know, it's just you get innovative and figure out how to work with it, so that both internally with the meditation, experimenting. And then externally, I mean, California, I mean, you really got the props. So there's lots of ways to work with it. Ajahn, thank you for this morning's talk on the recollections and faith. Could you elaborate on your point about faith and anagami? Has anyone been fully liberated through faith? Thank you. The thing is the nature of faith from the Buddha's perspective, of course, is that it has to be informed by wisdom and discernment, understanding. But it's so that it's sort of part of the path. I think to me, it's a part that does end up being sometimes overlooked or not really drawing on its full potential. So that to be fully liberated through faith alone wouldn't really work. But one recognizes that faith actually plays a large role in the path. And on a basic level, the function of faith is that it brings up effort. You think of there's different collections of teachings, and the Buddha was great at doing these lists of teachings, so that there's something called the five spiritual faculties: faith, effort, mindfulness, concentration, wisdom. And say the natural result of proper faith, or the natural result of faith, should be effort. Yeah. And if there's faith and no effort, then something's not working right. It's the faith that, misplaced faith in that it's all going to, I just believe in something or wait for the devas to reward my faith by facilitating my awakening somehow. It doesn't really work that way. What comes to mind is a very old cartoon from the New Yorker, and it's these two shabbily dressed men on a park bench. They have a wine bottle between them. And the caption is, "Let's face it, Sid, not having been born great, nor having achieved greatness, one can only assume we'll have it thrust upon us." So, one can sort of transpose that to the aspect, well, not having put forth effort, nor having... No, I haven't reflected on anything. must assume my faith will get me through. It doesn't quite work that way. So faith is in conjunction with these other faculties. But probably because of our Judeo-Christian background, our cultural conditioning, there's a lot of hesitation around faith and the concept of faith. And because of the what we've been exposed to, but I think it's worth revisiting the function of faith, and then also recognizing when it's properly applied, the strength that it does bring. And I mentioned this morning, so because it was kind of an insight that I had a long time ago, of that quality of faith was, you know, that was really what is a trigger for letting go and relinquishment. That the more one reflects, investigates, tries to figure it all out, analyzes it, you go circling around, and you know it's a good thing to let go or to relinquish. It's an act of faith to really let go of a habit, to let go of a mood, to let go of an attachment. Because you don't know what's going to fill up, come in its place, fill up, what's going to happen. So that faith plays a role. You know, it has to be informed, it has to be balanced with other things, but it does need to be attended to. And that aspect of faith and anagami, I just found it, that it's very striking in the suttas, where it's kind of a stock phrase that comes up in many, many places, where it's just that statement, where somebody's been practicing, or they've been reflecting on a particular teaching, or they've been really working at their practice in a particular way, and it doesn't quite come to the fulfillment of full liberation, but because of that kind of a faith and joy in the Dhamma, delight in Dhamma, desire for the Dhamma, that fills the heart to the extent that one can shed the coarser defilements and enter into and abide in anagami, which is the third stage of liberation. And that's a worthy goal. Would you kindly comment on the cultivation and use in one's Dhamma practice of one's creative gifts, such as music, art, dance, writing, and so on? It's always helpful to have a guideline, and think that what the Buddha points to as a general principle for, you know, whether it's application of creative gifts or however one applies one's attention to practice, that for it to support that cultivation, wholesome dhammas should increase, unwholesome dhammas should decrease. It's a very simple principle. So that by using different talents that one has and abilities, if one is able to use it in a way that the wholesome increases, and that which is unskillful is able to decrease, then that's a really good thing. And there are certain aspects of pitfalls that one needs to be attentive to in terms of one's creative gifts, is the identification that one has with, this is me, this is who I am, this is my special gift, and creating one's identity around that. And, you know, we create identities out of anything. So whether, some special talent that one has, or we are quite capable of creating a fixed identity around our utter hopelessness at something. So it's that tendency to create identity that's the problem. And to be able to use the different arts in a way that helps to foster a sense of peacefulness, focus. I'm thinking of music. What person who comes to mind is Reverend Hung Shur, who some people might know. He's one of the early students of Master Shun Hua from the City of 10,000 Buddhas. And he was a very talented musician. And when he was ordaining, he all of his music, his instruments, everything, gave them away, or he was going to give them away, and Master Hua sort of said, well, you know, you could use these. You could use that talent. He said, no, I'm just filled with defilement. I've got to get rid of this. And then Master Hua couldn't convince him otherwise, so when he recognized that he was going to give it all away, and his sort of comment was in English, and said, stupid. And then after about, I think it was about 25 years of being a monk, then he picked up his guitar and started to both write and play music, but it was all focused around Dhamma. And one can make the case for the fact that that 25 years definitely shaped the application of that music and that gift. Having that distance really helped him to clarify how to use that. But certainly he's been able to write and play Dhamma music. It's really, really quite helpful. And now he's into puppets. He's got some great puppet skits, Dhamma puppets. That creativity can be used really skillfully. And certainly in Buddhist cultures, then the different arts are used. Let's say the northeast of Thailand, where the forest tradition grew up and has flourished, one of the things that's a part of the culture is a type of Dhamma folk music. Molam is what it is. Usually the really good ones have at least a degree in Pali. And Ajahn Mun was actually, before he ordained, he was a really accomplished Molam singer. So that was why sometimes his, in teaching, he could really captivate an audience, because his command over that, he'd practiced and trained as a singer for so long that he was able to apply that to teaching, a skillful use of language. So it goes both ways. I think the pitfalls go around the identification, the worry and fear around wanting praise, fearing criticism, needing to be noticed. Because one doesn't need to have a particular talent for that, but it does sometimes complicate things. I've realized I'm like a fish in a verse of water, and was bringing that into practice, constantly rejecting what was happening and generally losing track of my meditation object, the breath. Can you speak a bit more about attitude versus and or object? Yeah, I think that is important to recognize. You set the tone for how we attend to our meditation object, and it has an effect. That quality of a traditional advice in meditation instruction I can remember that from Thailand, and I was looking at commentarial literature, both in the Theravada tradition as well as in Vajrayana tradition. And there's actually a lot of emphasis on establishing the proper preliminary mental state before even engaging in the object of the meditation. So that recollection of refuges is a really important preliminary laying a foundation of how we pay attention, loving kindness, that generating those thoughts of goodwill, of kindness toward oneself, generating towards others. And it's like laying that foundation for the right attitude towards the breath. Because if we don't do that, then our particular habits kick in. And whether it's aversion, ill will, critical faculties kicking in really quickly, or desire and grasping around trying to get particular experience from the desire mind, those need to be challenged and transformed. And so that those, that laying that foundation of a, of an attitude that helps to highlight and bring forth these fundamental wholesome qualities, this is, it's really important, essential. So that when one notices that the mind's going in a particular direction, say toward aversion, then rather than just swimming in that sort of sea, really coming back and laying that foundation of wholesome mental states. And you know, whether it's accomplished through faith or through refuges, through a recollection of the Buddha, as I was mentioning this morning, just being able to, looking at the shrine, looking at a Buddha image that is a symbol or an image of peace, of devotion. It's like a lot of the that can dissipate. I mean, it depends. You know, we can find fault and get averse to just about anything. But it's sort of like making that conscious and then recognizing, oh yeah, I really want to find a tool to ameliorate and transform that particular tendency. It's also, you know, as we use the breath, you also start to, like, to tuning in to the kind of the feeling tone of the body. You know, like, is there a tightening, a tensing, a pushing away, that kind of feeling of that comes from aversion, and it might not even be formulated into thoughts, but on a kind of a feeling tone of how we experience the body. What does that feel like as we breathe in, as we breathe out, or desire, or confusion and doubt? You know, we can experience that kind of, it's like a tone or a mood, and just being able to shift that with recognizing, oh, that's what my body does. That's what it feels like in my stomach. That's what it feels like in my chest when there's this sense of doubt and confusion or grasping and desire. This is where it comes. And being able to just relax and breathing in, breathing out, using the body as a, to lay a kind of a light, spacious, bright quality to the attitude and feeling of how we approach the practice, because it can easily, it's an attitudinal, it's a feeling tone that we can be working with. And it's a, it's just that simple. As we breathe in, as we breathe out, finding those avenues of opening up and exploring that.